KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Your country's in big trouble. Wait a minute. No, no. You've done a lot of talking. Your country is in big trouble.
A pretty contentious meeting at the White House today between President Trump and President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine.
For Friday, February 28th, this is All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Adrian Florido. New hope that a decades-long conflict between Turkey and a Turkish-Kurdish group could soon end.
They are Kurds, they have their identity, they have their language, they have their cultural and political rights that needs to be recognized.
Also, as the Trump administration cuts federal jobs, the downsizing at the National Park Service could get pretty obvious for summer tourists.
I truly believe that all Americans love the parks, and so we're here today fighting for them, fighting for their future. Mother Nature doesn't have her own voice, so she needs us right now.
And a preview of the Oscars this Sunday after this summary of the day's news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. European leaders have come to Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky's defense after his clash today in the Oval Office with President Trump and Vice President Vance. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports Europe is pushing back against Washington's increasing alignment with Russian President Vladimir Putin.
There's an aggressor, which is Russia, and a people attacked, which is Ukraine, said French President Emmanuel Macron, speaking shortly after Zelensky left the White House. In a statement, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer says his nation retains unwavering support for Ukraine and a lasting peace based on sovereignty and security for Ukraine and Europe. Both Starmer and Macron met with Trump this week to try to hammer home that point and to keep the U.S. aligned with Europe. German Foreign Minister Annalena Baerbock called Ukraine's defense of democracy our fight. EU Foreign Policy Chief and former Estonian President Kaja Kallas went further, saying, "It became clear today that the free world needs a new leader. It's up to us Europeans to take this challenge." Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Congressional bipartisan talks to keep the government open past a March deadline are facing new emerging complications. More from NPR's Claudio Grisales.
Congressional Republicans complain that Democrats are putting up new, quote, outrageous demands to keep the government open past a March 14th deadline. The stalemate has Senate appropriators asking for a short-term funding bill to buy more time for the talks. While President Trump and some Republicans say that stopgap plan should last a year instead, Democrats want the permanent year-long spending deal to limit Trump's ongoing efforts to dismantle certain federal programs and protect funding to entitlement programs such as Medicaid. House Leader Hakeem Jeffries has stopped short of saying if Democrats will force a government shutdown to get there, even as some members of his party say it's their only leverage. Claudia DeSales, NPR News.
As the measles outbreak continues in West Texas, the state's capital city of Austin has announced its first confirmed case of the disease since 2019. Libby Aldridge of member station KUT reports.
Austin Public Health announced an unvaccinated infant had contracted measles after traveling overseas with family. The case did not appear to be connected to the larger Texas outbreak, which has sickened dozens of people, most of them unvaccinated children. One child has died, the first U.S. measles death since 2015. Austin officials said the infant's case does not have any known exposures outside family, but they urged travelers to ensure they are vaccinated against measles before visiting the city for the annual South by Southwest conference, which begins next weekend. I'm Olivia Aldridge in Austin.
On Wall Street, the Dow closed up more than 600 points today. You're listening to NPR. Are sky-high egg prices solely the result of a bird flu outbreak, which has led to the slaughter of millions of chickens, or might some producers be taking advantage? That question is being posed by at least some advocacy groups, Democratic lawmakers, and a member of the Federal Trade Commission who wants a government investigation. Egg prices last month spiked to a record $4.95 a dozen, much more in some areas of the country. Officials in New York State say they've reached a tentative deal with shrinking corrections officers that will end a crisis in the state's prisons. It comes after Governor Kathy Hochul was forced to send National Guard troops to guard inmates. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
Corrections officers angered by safety and working conditions walked off the job in a wildcat strike not sanctioned by their union that's lasted nearly 2 weeks. Governor Hochul says a mediator has now reached a deal that should bring guards back, but there are sticking points. In a statement, the mediator said this deal will only go into effect after guards end their strike, as a state judge has ordered them to do. Also, the deal appears to give state prison officials broader authority to hold inmates in solitary confinement. One inmate advocacy group, the Halt Solitary Campaign, issued a statement describing that part of the deal as a violation of a state reform law passed in 2022 that limits use of isolation cells as a form of punishment. Brian Mann, NPR News.
Microsoft says it's shutting down its Skype video conferencing operation in order to focus on its Teams platform. Skype, which has also lost ground to more innovative platforms like Zoom, saying its users will be able to use their existing accounts to log on to Teams. Microsoft says it will shut down Skype in May. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the George Gund Foundation, working to make Cleveland more vibrant, sustainable, and just, and setting an example for the nation. More information available at gundfoundation.org. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. There was an extraordinary scene in the Oval Office today. President Trump and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky openly fighting about how to end Russia's war in Ukraine.
Your country is in big trouble.
Can I
ask? Wait a minute.
Sir,
no, no. You've done a lot of talking. Your country is in big trouble.
I know.
You're not winning.
I know.
You're not winning this. You have a damn good chance of coming out okay because of us.
Zelensky was at the White House to finalize a deal on minerals, a deal that Trump has said is a step towards the broader peace deal that he's trying to broker. But no deal was signed. The visit was cut short, lunch called off, a joint press conference canceled, and Zelensky left the White House. NPR White House correspondent Asma Khalid joins us now with more. Hi, Asma.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, what happened exactly during this meeting?
Mm-hmm. Well, this was in theory supposed to be the beginning of some sort of peace deal as Trump has envisioned it. And it actually began as a rather warm meeting. Trump praised Ukrainian fighters for being tough. And I will say, Elsa, it initially seemed like this meeting was going just akin to sort of any diplomatic meeting that Trump has had with a foreign leader in the Oval Office. But then near the end of a really lengthy question and answer session, things unraveled.
Clearly.
The cameras were rolling. And a contentious argument erupted between Trump and Zelensky. Vice President Vance then joined into the back and forth, and he chastised Ukraine's president, telling him that he has been unthankful for American support. And Elsa, it is the type of diplomatic public spat that you don't usually see in public. There was lots of shouting, crosstalk, pointing fingers. And I think to fully understand just how heated the meeting became, you've got to listen to it, and this is long, but take a listen.
You're not in a good position. You don't have the cards right now. With us, you start having
cards.
Right now, you don't.
You're
playing cards. You're playing cards. You're gambling with the lives of millions of people. You're gambling with World War III. You're gambling with World War III. And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country. That's backed
you
far more than a lot of people said they should have.
Have you said thank you once? This entire meeting? No, in this entire meeting, have you said thank you? You went to Pennsylvania and campaigned for the opposition in October. Offer some words of appreciation for the United States of America and the president who's trying to save your country.
Whoa. Okay, Asma, can you just step back and explain what they were fighting about right there?
So simply put, Ukraine has been pushing for security guarantees from the United States to prevent Russia from coming back in and seizing more territory if there is indeed a ceasefire. Trump has been reluctant to commit to that. He feels the United States has already spent a lot of money on this foreign war. And today, I mean, the leaders basically stated really fundamentally different positions. Trump said the U.S. has been overly generous in helping Ukraine, and Zelensky made it clear that he sees Ukraine's fight as an existential battle for the survival of his nation.
Okay. Well, how did Vice President Vance suddenly get involved in this whole conversation?
Well, there was this moment near the end of their meeting when Trump defended his approach with Russia's President Vladimir Putin. He said that he is not aligned with Putin. He is aligned, Trump said, with the United States, and he just wants this war to be over with. Vice President Vance jumped in to defend Trump's approach, and Zelensky had a really strong reaction. He said that Putin has broken agreements in the past and that he is not a trustworthy partner. And you know, this mineral deal that we mentioned at the outset, Zelensky and Trump were expected to sign that deal today. It would give the United States access to minerals in Ukraine.
Right.
It was supposed to be a step forward. But at the very end of this heated meeting, Trump seemed to have this threat for Ukraine's president.
The problem is, I've empowered you to be a tough guy. And I don't think you'd be a tough guy without the United States. And your people are very brave. But you're either going to make a deal or we're out. And if we're out, you'll fight it out. I don't think it's going to be pretty, but you'll fight it out. But you don't have the cards. But once we sign that deal, you're in a much better position. But you're not acting at all thankful. And that's not a nice thing. I'll be honest, that's not a nice thing.
Wow. Okay. Well, then after all of this shouting and lecturing, what happened next?
Well, the two men were supposed to have lunch. That did not happen. They were then supposed to have a joint press conference. That also got canceled. And then, of course, there is that mineral deal that was supposed to be signed. It was not signed today. And Elsa, it is not clear when and if it will actually be signed. The White House says Zelensky was told to leave. A White House official told me that Secretary of State Marco Rubio and Trump's national security advisor conveyed that message to the Ukrainian delegation. And later this afternoon, Trump told reporters that he thinks Zelensky wants to keep fighting, that he does not want to make peace, and that he feels like Zelensky overplayed his hand today.
Well, what did President Zelensky have to say after all of this happened?
Well, after he left the White House, he went on to do an interview with Fox News's Bret Baier. And the Fox host explicitly asked Zelensky if the public spat in front of the press today served Ukrainians well. And take a listen to Zelensky's answer.
This is not good for both sides anyway, and very open, but I can't, you know, change our Ukrainian attitude to Russia.
Zelensky said he understands that Trump is trying to be neutral, but he wants him to be more on the side of Ukraine. He also repeatedly insisted that Ukraine wants peace, and that's why he's here in the United States. He also said he's grateful for Americans' help, but he did not apologize to Trump.
Hmm. And real quick, Asma, I mean, what does this all mean for Ukraine? Like, what sort of reaction are you hearing from people outside the White House?
I mean, the reaction depends on where you fall on the political spectrum, right? I mean, I think it's to be expected amongst Republicans and Democrats. I will say that some reactions from Europe today made it clear that they are standing with Ukraine. And here at home in the United States, America's support for the war has been divisive. Polling shows that a sizable number of Americans, particularly Republicans, feel that the U.S. has provided too much money to Ukraine. But, you know, I think big picture, if today was intended to kick off some road to peace, it seems like for the moment that goal is shattered.
That is NPR's Asma Khalid. Thank you so much, Asma.
Good to speak with you.
It is Oscars weekend. Time to grab your ballot and mark your picks for Best Everything before Sunday night's Academy Awards telecast. What do you think for Best Picture? The green and pink witches musical Wicked? Or the trans drug lord musical Emilia Perez? Maybe Conclave, about choosing a new pope.
This is a conclave, Aldo. It's not a war.
It is a war.
Or Timothy Chalamet in either his Bob Dylan biopic, A Complete Unknown.
They say no one wants to hear what a kid wrote last month.
Or his sci-fi epic Dune Part 2.
May thy knife chip and shatter.
And that's just half the Best Picture nominees. Who better to talk us through the possibilities than NPR's movie critic, Bob Mondillo? Hey, Bob.
It's good to be here.
So before we go further, remind us of the other possible Best Pictures.
Well, you just hit most of the big box office hits, except for The Substance, a body horror satire starring Demi Moore. There's also Anora, a modern-day Cinderella story centered on a sex worker in New York. The Brutalist, a 3.5-hour drama about an immigrant architect after World War II. Nickel Boys, about two kids in a racist 1960s reform school. And the Brazilian drama I'm Still Here, about coping with life in a dictatorship. It's a cheery little bunch.
I remember last year, Oppenheimer seemed to have Best Picture wrapped up weeks before the ceremony, Bob. Is there a front runner this time?
Well, it's been changing. When the nominations first came out, Emilia Perez got 13 and was instantly regarded as the film to beat. Mm. Among other things, it had Carla Sofia Gascon, the first trans performer ever nominated in an acting category. But then some offensive tweets she'd made years ago resurfaced, and both the star and the film lost their luster.
Did something else step up?
People were high on the Pope election thriller Conclave for a bit. If it wins, the timing will certainly be poignant with Pope Francis hospitalized, though it's worth noting that Oscar voting was completed before he went into the hospital. And lately there's a lot of chatter about the sex worker Cinderella story, Anora, but only the accounting firm PricewaterhouseCoopers knows for sure.
Bob, besides handing out awards, the Oscars telecast is a show in itself. Conan O'Brien is hosting this year. What can we expect?
Well, he famously steers clear of political material, so I'm guessing his monologue won't include a lot of Trump jokes. And then, if I'm understanding correctly, they will not sing the Best Song nominees, but there will be, and I'm quoting here, powerful musical moments that connect film's rich history to its bold and inspiring future, whatever that means. Cynthia Erivo and Ariana Grande, the stars of Wicked, will be performing, but none of the Wicked songs are nominatable because they're from the Broadway musical. If it were up to me, I would have them sing the song For Good, which will otherwise debut when Wicked Part 2 comes out at Thanksgiving. Remember, this first movie is just the first act, but it's not up to me.
I wish it were up to you. What about the Best Song nominees, Bob? They're just not going to do them?
Well, it's sort of under wraps, but it sounds as if what they're thinking is to go behind the scenes a bit and talk to the songwriters. There will be other pop stars performing, though, including Queen Latifah and Doja Cat. I'd be surprised if they don't celebrate the work of musical legend Quincy Jones, who died in November. And there will also be some sort of tribute to the first responders who fought the fires that raged through Los Angeles just a month or so ago.
So timing, Bob, do we need to tune in early?
Yes, at 7 p.m. with the red carpet starting at 6:30 p.m. To ABC or Hulu. That's an hour earlier than usual, a strategy for getting more viewers to stick with the show longer, I guess. But 7 p.m. on the East Coast means 4 in the afternoon for the celebrities attending in Los Angeles. If all goes according to schedule, it'll just have gotten dark when the after parties start.
Early to bed, then. It's NPR's Bob Mondillo. Thanks, Bob.
My pleasure.
It's never too late for a wide open slate, a kiss from a stranger, a thousand first.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams. Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at MacFound.org.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Elsa Chang. There has been a major development in an armed conflict that has raged for decades between Turkey and a Kurdish group in Turkey. The group's founder has now called for followers to disarm and disband. NPR's Gina Raff has more from Damascus, Syria.
This was a Turkish politician, Ahmed Turk, reading an extraordinary statement from a Kurdish leader imprisoned for the last quarter century. All groups must lay down their arms and the PKK dissolve itself. That was the message from Abdullah Öcalan, who founded the militant PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, in 1978 to fight for Kurdish rights in Turkey. Members of the Turkish party applauding the statement hope the move could end a decades-long conflict that has killed tens of thousands of people. Turkey, with the help of the U.S., arrested Öcalan in 1999 and has kept him in an island prison in solitary confinement ever since. Öcalan, 75, is revered by millions of Kurds, including those at this rally. Many call him Apo, Kurdish for uncle. Turkey has ensured that no one has publicly heard his voice in 26 years. The delegation of Turkish politicians are among the very few visitors he has been allowed. Kurdish leaders mostly welcome the call. Barham Saleh, a Kurd, is a former Iraqi president and now a senior fellow at Harvard Kennedy School. He says this is a chance to shape the future.
This is not a mere afterthought. You have nearly 40 to 50 million Kurds spanning these countries across the Middle East. They are Kurds, they have their identity, they have their language, they have their cultural and political rights that needs to be recognized.
Öcalan's goal when he founded the party was to create an independent Kurdistan. For decades, lightly armed guerrilla fighters based in the mountains spanning Turkey and Iraq battled Turkey's powerful military. In the 1990s, the PKK declared it was no longer seeking separatism. But Turkey and the U.S. classify the PKK as a terrorist group. Öcalan, in his statement, wrote Turkey had made progress in recognizing Kurdish rights. He said democracy was now the way forward. If the PKK does disband, it could pave the way for an agreement between Kurds who control northeastern Syria and are affiliated with the PKK branch and the new Syrian government. Jane Araf, NPR News, Damascus.
Many federal jobs that the Trump administration has eliminated are for government work done behind the scenes. But downsizing at the National Park Service affects people quite literally at the scenes. In the Southwest, people are taking notice even before spring break and summer vacations. KUER's David Condos reports from Zion National Park in Utah.
This is typically the slow season at Zion National Park. But on a recent Saturday morning, there's a long line of cars waiting to get in. Just two of the four entrance stations at the park's main gate are open. Now, it's unclear if that's due to the National Park Service jobs President Trump cut. The White House isn't confirming details about it, but Democratic lawmakers and employee groups say it's about 1,000 jobs nationwide. Zion National Park declined to comment. People around here are worried, though.
Today's just a day in February, and look at the line. So we're more concerned about the, not the big holidays, but the everyday kind of traffic and congestion that we might experience.
Barbara Bruno is the mayor of Springdale, the town closest to Zion's main entrance. She says around a dozen Zion Rangers lost their jobs, and the long line of cars to get into the park is backed up into town, where locals are protesting.
Take a stand, protect the land.
More than 100 people chant and carry signs against a backdrop of towering Red Rock peaks. They're upset about the firings and worry about what that means for the future of public lands. Local business owner Jay Sean Anderson organized the protest.
I truly believe that all Americans love the parks, and so we're here today fighting for them, fighting for their future. Mother Nature doesn't have her own voice, so she needs us right now.
Visitor numbers start rising dramatically in March here. Last year, nearly 5 million people came to Zion. On busy days, Mayor Bruno says the line of cars can block Springdale residents from their homes and make it hard for emergency vehicles to get through. She says firing so many workers also makes it hard for staff who remain on the job.
They're beloved members of our community, and I feel for them. I think that they're all sort of worried about what the future holds, and the park was already understaffed and underfunded.
Inside Zion, Helena Parks is taking a photo. She's visiting from California and says she's a federal worker too. Overall, she agrees with the job cuts.
The new presidency comes in. They're trying to do something good. Not everybody sees it that way, but it's an action.
While losing park jobs is unfortunate, she says, it may be a necessary part of reining in the federal budget. But Bill Wade, the head of the Association of National Park Rangers, expects tourists to notice the reduced staffing, from shorter hours at visitor centers to dirtier bathrooms.
When you use a broadsword instead of a scalpel to go through 1,000 positions and indiscriminately terminate them, I just don't see that as being the efficient way to do things.
A memo obtained by NPR says the Park Service has permission to hire a larger number of seasonal staff than in previous years. But Wade says,
I think it's unlikely that all of those seasonals are going to be hired and on board before the heavy use season actually gets underway.
In the meantime, unions have filed lawsuits over how the Trump administration eliminated jobs, including at the Park Service. Now, many of the fired workers were probationary, meaning they were new to the agency or had recently started new roles there. One of them was Macy Monahan, a biologist at Utah's Bryce Canyon National Park.
When I got removed from my position illegally, I was 10 days away from being off my probationary period. I was hoping and praying that it wouldn't happen.
But then she got the mass termination email that went out on Valentine's Day. It told her she was fired for poor performance, even though she says her reviews were positive.
I wasn't slacking off and wasting taxpayer money. I was out in the field for 10 hours a day. I was working in unstable weather conditions or getting down and dirty with some prairie dogs at times. You know, I'm out in the field doing hard work.
So getting that email hurt. She worries it'll end up hurting the parks too. Monahan says Bryce Canyon was already short-staffed relative to its millions of visitors. So she and the other rangers often worked above and beyond to keep it running.
My passions are still there. And, you know, I hope and pray we can kind of get back to what we were doing before, eventually.
Until then, she's not sure what will happen to the projects she was working on. For NPR News, I'm David Kondos at Zion National Park.
This is NPR News.
The Department of Government Efficiency, better known as DOGE, is aiming to cut millions of dollars from the federal budget by slashing jobs and gutting government agencies. But how much money is DOGE itself costing the government, and where is that money coming from? I'm Scott Detrow. An investigation into how DOGE is funded on All Things Considered from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Elsa Chang. The Black Gospel Archive at Baylor University has spent decades collecting and digitizing gospel records.
It is the music that endured, and the greatest records we have of a period in American life, as shameful as it was.
That story after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Hurst. A shouting match broke out at the White House today in a meeting between President Trump, Ukrainian President Zelensky, and Vice President Vance. Trump wanted a minerals deal between Ukraine and the U.S. signed as payback for previous U.S. support while peace talks continue. Trump exploded after Zelensky warned Trump not to trust Russia. Trump said Zelensky was being disrespectful.
You got to be more thankful. Because let me tell you, you don't have the cards. With us, you have the cards. But without us, you don't have any cards.
Zelensky left the meeting without signing a deal allowing the U.S. access to rare earth minerals in Ukraine. Later, Trump, speaking to reporters as he left the White House for his Florida estate, said Zelensky doesn't want peace. Two notorious Mexican cartel leaders have entered not guilty pleas in federal court in New York. The arraignments took place a day after the drug lords were among 29 high-level cartel figures transferred to the U.S. by the Mexican government. NPR's Ryan Lucas has more.
Rafael Caro Quintero and Vicente Carrillo Fuentes face charges in separate cases related to their alleged roles in smuggling huge quantities of drugs into the United States. Caro Quintero has been a target for U.S. law enforcement for decades. He was convicted in Mexico in the 1980s for the murder of DEA agent Enrique Camarena. Caro Quintero was released from a Mexican prison more than a decade ago and went into hiding before eventually being taken back into custody. Here's the acting U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, John Durham.
You can never kill a DEA agent, and you will never get away with it.
Both defendants are expected back in court next month. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
Crude oil prices lower by the close, down about a half percent at $69.95 a barrel. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. The World Health Organization says it's carrying out more investigations to understand the cause of an illness that's been spreading in communities in Democratic Republic of the Congo. NPR's Fatma Tanis has more.
Since the beginning of the year, the DRC has recorded over 1,000 sick people and 60 deaths from an unnamed disease. The symptoms include fever, headache, chills, body aches, and nosebleeds. The WHO says it's deployed emergency experts to step up disease surveillance and determine what's causing these symptoms. Initial lab results were negative for Ebola and Marburg, two viruses that can cause similar symptoms. Areas where the illness has spread are remote, adding transportation and communication challenges for the emergency team. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
The Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins tonight. In Gaza, many Palestinians are trying to put together what little they have to prepare for festivities and mark the holiday. In Israel, security has been tightened with reinforcements of border and district police in several locations, including the Old City of Jerusalem, home to many holy sites, including the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Microsoft says Skype, the pioneering free video calling app, will shut down in May to be replaced by a free version of its Teams app. Skype users will be able to transfer old account data, though, to the new Teams account. I'm Janine Herbst, and you're listening to NPR News from Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. And from ECMC Foundation at ECMCFoundation.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Hundreds of supporters of LGBTQ rights protested in the Iowa Capitol building this week. The protest came as Iowa became the latest state to reduce the rights of transgender people. It's part of a wave of Republican-led states that have cut transgender access to bathrooms, sports, and health care. And Iowa's legislature took it one step further. It moved to strip gender identity as a protected class from the state's civil rights law. That is something that transgender advocates say has not happened in any other state. Iowa Public Radio's Katerina Sestarek is here with more. Hi, Katerina.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so I understand that this bill was rushed through the state House and state Senate just yesterday. What does it do exactly?
It removes anti-discrimination protections for transgender people from state law. Now, to step back for a second, the Iowa legislature added gender identity and sexual orientation as protected categories to the Iowa Civil Rights Act in 2007. Mm-hmm. Democrats were in charge back then, and this had bipartisan support. And the law is meant to prevent discrimination in housing, employment, public accommodations, and more.
Okay.
Now, Republicans are saying that if gender identity stays in the civil rights law, it could make it easier to overturn other laws they've been passing to limit transgender rights. Here's an example of what supporters are saying about it. Ryan Benn is a lobbyist for the Family Leader, a very influential Christian conservative group in Iowa. He says putting gender identity in the Civil Rights Act has had dreadful results because transgender women have been allowed into women's bathrooms and sports teams.
Let's make Iowa the first state to correct course. It's time to come back to our senses. It is right and good for our laws to recognize the real difference between men and women.
And the Republican governor, Kim Reynolds, signed the bill into law this afternoon.
Okay, so there's no question this new law erodes the civil rights of transgender people. Can you just tell us, how are transgender rights advocates responding right now?
Well, they say this will make it easier to discriminate against transgender people, to do things like deny them housing, jobs, maybe even hotel rooms. And opponents of the bill say that it effectively erases transgender people from state law and public life and just sends an overall message that they're not welcome in the state. I called the national LGBTQ rights group Lambda Legal today and talked to Whit Washington, a senior attorney for the Non-Binary and Transgender Rights Project. They say Iowa was one of the first states to put protections for transgender people into its civil rights law.
To see an early adopter of the protection be an early adopter of turning their backs on an already vulnerable population is upsetting.
Washington and other opponents of the bill say this could also be a slippery slope to taking other protected characteristics out of the civil rights law. And some Republican activists have been asking state lawmakers to take sexual orientation out, too.
On that point, do you think other states might take Iowa's lead here on removing civil rights protections for transgender people?
Well, Washington with Lambda Legal says this could open the door to more states taking gender identity out of their Civil Rights Act. About half of states have specific civil rights protections for transgender people in their laws. Most of those are Democratic-led states, so they may be less likely to do this, but advocates are concerned given what's going on around the country.
Okay, and real quick, looking at transgender rights more broadly, how does what's happening in Iowa fit in with what you're seeing across the U.S. now?
Yeah, Republican states, including Iowa, have passed laws regarding access to bathrooms, banning trans athletes in women's sports, and more. Lambda Legal says there were more than 450 bills proposed this year across the country to limit transgender rights. And some Democrats and transgender activists say that Republicans are demonizing a vulnerable small population, and they'll keep fighting these efforts.
That is Katerina Sestarek of Iowa Public Radio. Thank you, Katerina.
Thanks, Elsa.
It's been a difficult week at the U.S. Agency for International Development. The agency was already reeling from firings and funding freezes. Then the Trump administration announced it was cutting nearly all of USAID's grants and awards. Only some 500 will continue. For For Dean Carlin, the news was unfathomable. Carlin was USAID's chief economist, charged with helping design more cost-effective programs. But earlier this week, he resigned.
I just emailed USAID and told them, I hereby cancel the contract. And that was it. No fanfare.
It was a decision weeks in the making. Here is reporter Ari Daniel.
The sinking feeling began in earnest a week after the Trump administration took over in January.
It was really clear that something fundamental was going to be done when there was 58 of us that were senior managers, senior people within USAID were all put on administrative leave and with no stated reason.
When a reason did surface the next day, the explanation made no sense to Carlin, who's also a professor of economics at Northwestern University, which made him suspect something else was going on.
This is likely DOGE figuring out a blueprint for how to dismantle any agency, and we were seeing USAID the first to go. Why USAID? One argument can be that the benefits of USAID are not seen in the day-to-day of people's lives in most of America.
Even though, Carlin says, the benefits are very real. In his view, foreign aid is good for both recipient and donor.
It makes countries wealthier, makes the countries more stable. Not only does that increase trade, it lowers civil unrest, makes America safer. And that's basically what we mean by the soft power of foreign aid, that you can actually help people and at the same time further American interests.
Carlin's role at USAID was to get more bang for the buck by asking and answering a set of questions.
Did the program work? Did it actually change lives? That's what we're trying to champion, because that's ultimately what I care about, is does it actually generate the impact that's desired?
Carlin had hoped this approach would resonate with Marco Rubio when the former senator was appointed as Secretary of State.
Senator Rubio has a long track record of recognizing the value of foreign aid. I was sure that he had ideas on how to reform, and I was keen to work with USAID to help push those reforms through. And so that's where I was, you know, upon his nomination, hoping that it would align with what he had been saying for the past 10 years.
But instead of reform, Carlin watched programs, including some rather cost-effective ones, get frozen or canceled. Payments were suspended. Mass layoffs rocked the agency. He saw his colleagues demonized.
I was sad and frustrated for the thousands of people who are stripped of their career, a career that was spent dedicated working for other people and helping other people. My hope was that maybe there would be a point where Rubio recognizes this is too far and stops the carnage.
That didn't happen. In fact, the State Department would go on to announce that Rubio personally reviewed numerous USAID grants before eliminating 92% of them. Carlin's early feelings of puzzlement had given way to a mix of devastation and horror.
Look, there's people that are going to die because of what's happened, like a lot of people. There's going to be other people that are just radically worse off and sick and not educated in the same way. It's a million tragedies that didn't have to be done this way.
Carlin knew what he had to do. He resigned on Tuesday. The next day was when the termination of nearly all USAID programs was announced. Carlin says this level of evisceration, while always a possibility, was, quote, simply too heartless and senseless to fathom actually happening. For NPR News, I'm Ari Daniel.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. California's adoption rate for electric vehicles is higher than anywhere in the country. And when it comes to Teslas, one in three sold last year in the U.S. were sold in California. But ever since Tesla founder Elon Musk took a central role in the Trump administration, Tesla's stock prices have declined by about a third since inauguration. And some Tesla drivers in California are feeling conflicted. Cap Radio's Laura Fitzgerald reports.
On any given day in Berkeley, you're likely to see what looks like a motorcade of identical Teslas driving by. But lately, more and more Tesla drivers in this notoriously liberal city are putting anti-Elon Musk bumper stickers on their cars. Fred Liao has one of these stickers. He pulls up to the Berkeley Trader Joe's in his Model 3.
I feel ashamed driving Tesla now. I don't think it's right to very rich people to influence our decision-making process in a so kind of direct way.
At a grocery store across town, Christine Will parks her Model X. She doesn't have a sticker, but is in the market for one. What is yours going to say, you think?
That I bought it before I knew he was nuts, basically.
Will was an early Tesla adopter. She says she got her car back in 2016.
I was on board with the, whole EV, climate change, all of that, and was excited about the range. You want to do what you can, but I, at the same time, don't want to be supporting this.
Not everyone in Berkeley feels this way. Vipul Garg likes that his Tesla is better for the environment and says he doesn't really pay much attention to Musk.
His opinions are his opinions. The product he's making is different from the person.
Meanwhile, other Tesla drivers are taking their resistance a step further and trying to sell their cars. Recent data from the California Energy Commission shows that EV sales leveled off in 2024 after years of rapid growth. Tesla sales dropped by more than 10% in the state. EV experts say Tesla's dip likely has a lot to do with increased competition from other manufacturers. But is it possible that some people's disapproval of Musk and Tesla could start to impact California's broader EV market?
Yes, because Tesla's such a large part of the market, I think there's a very real chance that this can have an effect on the market overall.
James Salee is an EV and economic expert at UC Berkeley. He says EVs are more likely to be adopted in more liberal and affluent regions, like Berkeley. It's too soon to tell, but he says if drivers in these communities sell their Teslas and opt for a different EV, it's possible people in redder parts of the country could end up buying them.
Then on net, we could get an increase in electric vehicles if suddenly Elon Musk's identity switch causes an embrace of electric vehicles in the part of America that had very low take-up previously.
Tesla didn't respond to a request for comment about the recent dip in sales in California or backlash from some consumers against the company. Protests against Musk have been popping up in liberal areas around the country. Some have been small, but in Berkeley, over 100 people came out to protest in front of a Tesla showroom. Protester Matthew O'Neill said he had friends who lost their jobs as part of Musk and Trump's efforts to shrink the federal workforce.
And Doge and Elon have no idea what they do. They do great work, and now they're out jobs.
I ask O'Neill whether he feels like Musk's politics impact his willingness to get an electric car. He says he already drives an EV, but it isn't a Tesla. For NPR News, I'm Laura Fitzgerald in Berkeley.
This is NPR News. From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Elsa Chang. A federal system for conducting background checks on police officers has gone offline thanks to an executive order by President Trump. He revoked a package of police reforms implemented by former President Biden back in 2022. The reforms range from setting national accreditation standards to reporting use of force. NPR's Martin Costi joins us now to talk about it. Hi, Martin.
Hi, Elsa.
Okay, so wasn't this background check system like one of the more prominent initiatives of Biden's policing plan? Can you just describe it in more detail?
Sure. Well, it was called the National Law Enforcement Accountability Database. It was basically a system for tracking the records of people who'd worked as federal law enforcement officers and were applying for different jobs in policing. The idea here was to prevent something called wandering cops. That's officers who commit misconduct in one place and then they hide that history when they apply for work somewhere else.
Okay, and then without this background check system, will it just make it harder for police departments to catch job applicants with problems in their past?
Well, in some cases, you have to keep in mind that this is a database for federal officers, say DEA agents or Border Patrol, and they're just a fraction of American law enforcement. The good news here for local police departments doing the hiring is they still have access to a privately run system called the National Decertification Index, where they can still get histories of state and local officers. The NDI was kind of a model for the federal system, and it's still operating. I talked to Brian Grisham, who helps to run it, and he points to a growing interest in that system, especially since 2020.
The public and law enforcement demand for accountability. And we've been around for 25 years and have just seen it grow from 30-something states to all states participating.
And the other thing about the NDI, Grisham says it doesn't need federal grants anymore to operate. And so the White House couldn't cancel it even if it wanted to.
Well, this federal database made it easier to do background checks for former federal officers. So do we know why the White House took it down?
Well, it's kind of hard to figure out. Trump himself actually ordered the creation of just this kind of database back in July of 2020 during the height of the protests about policing. And the White House has not said anything specifically against that system. But it does appear to have been caught up in this first day avalanche of Trump executive orders back in January. At the time, the White House said that it was revoking this long list of Biden executive orders because of, quote, unlawful and radical DEI ideology.
I mean, what message do you think Trump's changes are sending to local police? Like, do they get the sense this whole era of police reform is over or about to be over?
Well, not necessarily. You have to remember that a lot of the changes of the past few years, such as better tracking of use of force, happened at the state level. I talked to Chuck Wexler about this. He runs the Police Executive Research Forum in Washington. It's kind of an independent policing think tank.
Right.
And he's not expecting any hard U-turns.
I think what you see in American policing is we've had 10 years of systematic change and reform in police. Police have worked really hard to really examine their practices on use of force, on dealing with the community. I don't think that's going to change based upon what happens here in Washington.
At the same time, he does say the chiefs are kind of keeping a low profile right now. For instance, departments that get federal grants for reform, they're not eager to talk to me right now about all of that, perhaps to avoid attracting negative attention from the budget cutters.
Okay, well, with this background check database gone, what is left of Biden's original 2022 order on policing?
Well, some of the actions Biden took don't get automatically reversed. For instance, body camera policies. Agencies were ordered to set those up. Federal officers have been lagging behind local officers with body cameras, but those still seem to be in place. I talked to the U.S. Marshals and Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and they say they're sticking with their Biden-era body camera policies. At least that's what they're saying right now.
That is NPR's Martin Costi. Thank you so much, Martin.
You're welcome.
The Black Gospel Archive at Baylor University is one of the largest digital collections of gospel music in the world. For two decades, the archive has collected and digitized more than 60,000 gospel songs, creating a searchable online database of previously unattainable records. The project's next challenge is to hunt down rare and hard-to-find songs and oral histories, and it's received a $2.4 million grant to do that. KWBU's Molly Jo Tilton reports from Waco, Texas.
Tucked in the corner of Baylor University's Memorial Library, the Black Gospel Archive's walls are packed from top to bottom with records, cassettes, and sheet music, reflecting decades of music history.
Since I gave to Jesus my poor broken heart, he never had left me.
The archive houses and digitizes the gospel records that are most vulnerable. those recorded in the golden era of gospel. This is roughly 1945 to 1980, and once those records disappear, they'll be gone forever. Songs like The Old Ship of Zion, performed by the choir The Mighty Wonders of Owasco, Maryland. The original records were sold at church performances, but now only two copies are known to remain.
Step on board if you want to see Jesus. Just step on board and follow me.
Anyone with an internet connection can listen to these songs. The archive also holds important artifacts, like recorded preachings, concert announcements, sheet music, and blog posts, aiming to preserve the history of Black gospel culture as well. Gospel historian Robert Darden said this is part of what inspired the creation of the archive nearly two decades ago.
It is the music that endured, and now it continues to be one of the greatest legacies and the greatest records we have of a period in American life, as shameful as it was.
At a time when Black Americans were protesting segregation and discrimination, gospel boomed as a form of protest, often sung both to boost spirits and in defiance.
We shall overcome.
Songs like We Shall Overcome became anthems for the civil rights protesters.
We shall overcome.
That's going to help us understand those who came before.
Thanks to a Lilly Endowment grant awarded earlier this year, the archive will expand the recorded history of gospel by collecting oral histories from those who lived it.
There are people that are still alive in their 80s and 90s that need to be interviewed. It's going to allow me to go to them and interview them and ask them questions about their church history and about gospel music artists.
That's Stephen Newby, the archive's ambassador. He says oral histories are some of the most important elements the archive is missing.
I see gaps in the story, and this grant is going to allow me to take some time and attempt to fill some of those gaps.
Newby says that there is no way to know how many uncatalogued gospel records remain, but the team will keep digitizing them as long as people keep sending them. The grant will also help hire new full-time staff and fund a four-year concert series starting in Chicago and Detroit. For KWBU, I'm Molly Jo Tilton in Waco, Texas.
And member station KWBU receives some station funding from Baylor University, the home of the archive.
For my Lord, and I promised him that I...
Thank you for listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Arm, committed to delivering innovative, advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm. Arm.com. From Eric and Wendy Schmidt, through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all, on the web at theschmidt.org. From Moderna, committed to protecting people from COVID-19, the CDC recommends getting a second dose of this season's COVID-19 vaccine for those 65 and older. Doctors can advise about getting a second dose. And from the Skoll Foundation, dedicated to powering...
A little experience of some young chickens of today. I'm gonna give you a little experience of some young chickens of today. They are full of disappointments. They are never, never on time. They don't keep to an appointment.